Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City, a journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and today my guest is Dr. Falestin Naili. Falestin is a historian associated with the Institut Français du Prochain Orient in Amman. Falestin specializes in the social history of the late Ottoman and Mandate Palestine and also Jordan, and has focused much on a recent research on local governance and politics, particularly in Jerusalem. She's interested in collective memory and oral history, and she's connecting the past with the present, and also she looks at this connection through the politics of heritage and folklore. Now, on a personal note, I'm a fan of the work, and I must say that a few years back in a conference, she whispered a magic word in my ears that now has become a sort of a mantra, and obviously it's also central in Falestin works, which is the concept of demunicipalization. We will get there, but first of all, Falestin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Roberto.
As usual, season two, but I'm not going to change. The first question is, Falestin, what is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
Well, I guess there's several layers to my connection. The first one, obviously, is personal. There's a lot of childhood memories of going to the old city with my grandmother and spending time in the city as a child. So, yeah, that's but not being a Jerusalemite, it was a different approach. It was more of a visiting moment. So that's one level. And I remember this memory of especially the Haram Sharif as a sort of safe haven and as a sort of space for sociability in a city that sometimes as a child I already saw as rather stressful. So yeah, that's one level. Now, the next level, I guess, is my doctoral research, where I tended to approach the city from the outside, from the rural hinterland, because I devoted my PhD to the village of Artas, which is 12 kilometers south of Jerusalem, and is actually linked to the city with the ancient system of aqueducts, taking water from the sources that are located in the Artas Valley all the way to Jerusalem. So yeah, that's another aspect. Jerusalem is sort of the central city with Bethlehem as the central town for the village of Artas. And it's the place where people would sell their produce. And yeah, so this is more like the rural approach, let's say, to the big city. The other perspective is very much an inside perspective, and that's the perspective of the municipal council. So during the last 10 years, I've been working in different teams of different sizes on the Ottoman municipality of Jerusalem in particular. And that gives me a rather down-to-earth perspective on the city. So yeah, I guess it's an articulation of those three perspectives.
I want to start talking about the question of the municipality. I mean, Jerusalem 2021 is a large city divided in many ways with invisible borders, but we know they do exist. And in theory, there is only one municipality which should take care of all of its citizens, but as we know, it doesn't. Now, the municipality of Jerusalem, however, is nothing new, is not a contemporary institution. In fact, it was born in the late 19th century. And I was wondering if you can give us a sense of how the municipality came about and how the Ottomans understood this institution and who did it serve? I mean, why a municipality in Jerusalem?
Well, the municipality actually is not something that came out of nowhere. It's an institution that evolved from other models of municipal government without them being municipal in that sense, nor that term being used. So of course, as you know, there's the system of guilds, the Nakib al-Ashraf, and this entire system of urban governance that predated the later Ottoman period when municipalities sort of became formalized from the 1860s onwards. And Jerusalem actually was among the very first cities in the Ottoman Empire to create a municipal council in that sense. And that's rather significant also, and it speaks to the importance of the city on the level of the empire.
Some historians in the past, when discussing a municipality, particularly under the Ottomans, obviously, there was this kind of negative approach. Obviously, they couldn't deny its presence, but they also agreed that it was not really effective, that certainly did not represent local people, and they had, and this is certainly true, they also had to contend with foreign presence, particularly the consuls. So I always had the feeling, particularly, you know, in my own work, but also reading more contemporary works, that actually the municipality had some sort of appeal, and they were able to achieve goals. Obviously, it was not easy in the general context of the Ottoman Empire. So I was wondering, what is your assessment of that institution, particularly before World War I, so before the end of the Ottoman municipality, which obviously then changed radically with the arrival of the British?
Yeah, actually, I think the municipality was a really crucial institution. And it was in many ways an important link between the local level and the imperial level of politics, and between local aspirations for the city and the aspirations that the empire had at a time when it also wanted to consolidate its hold on the city. So I think that the municipal council in some ways really knew how to work within that particular conjunction, which was the end of the Ottoman period, when Jerusalem really started to grow, when its importance also on the level of the empire increased because it became a mutasarriflik. And so all of this led to, I think, a municipal council that was rather assertive, even though, of course, as all municipal councils within the empire, they didn't have huge budgets. I mean, you know, they had to sort of work with whatever income they could generate, notably from stores that they owned, in order to then pay for a part of the expenditures that they had to do. Then there were also some empire-led initiatives, of course, in terms of infrastructure, etc. But there was, of course, also a huge budget constraint that we have to take into consideration when we look at the actions that the municipality could undertake.
I was wondering if you can give us a sense of the people that were part of a municipal council, essentially, you know, who are these people that are either elected or, you know, named by the Ottoman authorities? Did they represent all the communities? What kind of relationship they had with each other and with, obviously, the constituents, with the citizens of a city?
Yeah, there's two really important dynamics to keep in mind. One is the censitary barrier, which meant that only men of a certain age and a certain income, paying a certain amount of property taxes, could actually vote. So this censitary barrier, of course, just like it did still in many countries in Europe, meant that the pool of voters was rather limited, and the pool of candidates, of course, also very limited, even more so. But there's another dynamic which is particular in Jerusalem, which is the Ottoman census, the nufus. During Ottoman census, only Ottoman souls were counted. And so it was clear that only Ottoman subjects would be eligible to either be electors or to be candidates for election if they had the necessary resources. And I think it's Johann Bissau who estimated that the percentage of the population who actually voted in Jerusalem municipal elections at the end of the Ottoman period didn't exceed maybe 3% of the population. Nonetheless, there was a principle of election. We're not in a logic of representation and not in a logic of quota, confessional quota or whatever other quota. We're in a logic of democratic election, however limited that right of election was.
I think the work of Johann highlighted this question of the fact that there was like only 3%. But as you mentioned, I mean, given the historical context, in many places, people simply couldn't vote and there was no right of vote whatsoever. So this was a great advance. Yes, it was only 3%. And yet you have this principle of democratization, if we can use the word, which is certainly is problematic. And again, I remember kind of old historiography often painting this period in time as neglected and, you know, simply ending with sentences like, well, the Ottomans ruled Jerusalem. World War I happened, the British came, and here we are. This is modernity, this is the new municipality. But the reality is that even British Jerusalem was not born out of the blue, but the municipal institution and other institutions pre-existed the British arrival. And I think this is an important element to remember, particularly those who have no really knowledge of, you know, that part of history of Jerusalem and only look at the contemporary. But there's a long history of municipality in and of Jerusalem. But before moving to the British municipality, I wanted to bring you back to your work and focus a little bit on the surrounding of Jerusalem, because this is something that I never touched upon with previous guests. And I was wondering what was the relationship between, you know, communities surrounding the city and the city itself. So in your case, the people of Artas.
Yeah, the people of Artas had a double link to the city. It was one of the most important markets for their agricultural products, of course, like many other villages in the area. But then there was this water link, which was really fundamental and which really structured, I think, the relationship between Artas and Jerusalem for centuries. I mean, this Roman aqueduct basically conferred a certain status on the village and on the inhabitants. And that we know that during certain periods, and notably during the Ottoman period, the people of the village had sort of guardianship of the infrastructure. You know, the infrastructure comprises the Berak Suleiman, the reservoirs, and of course the aqueduct. And it was really fundamental for somebody to watch over this aqueduct so that the water wouldn't be entirely taken up by other populations along the about 20 kilometer distance that this aqueduct had to pass in order to get to Jerusalem. So this really created a particular relationship, and it made Artas in many ways closer to dynamics that were unfolding in Jerusalem than other villages of the Bethlehem area.
What do we know about the people? I mean, in terms of like social, but also political relationships. I mean, you mentioned that there was a market, and of course there is water, which is crucial, given that there is no really water in the region. There's a scarcity of water. Did people of Artas have some sort of power over Jerusalem, or because it was a tiny village, in the end they had to somehow suffer? I know it's not probably the right word, but sort of you know, the rule of a city, and so they didn't really have this much leverage vis-a-vis Jerusalemites.
There were conflicts throughout the many centuries that have linked Artas and Jerusalem through water. One of the conflicts, for example, was during the Mandate period, which I know we're going to be getting to later. You know, when there was scarcity in Jerusalem, of course, the administrators of the city were trying to find a way to increase the water that would come to the city. And Artas was an obvious location where they were trying to pump more. And so Vincent Lemire, for example, has touched upon this, not touched about this, but really actually analyzed this in a really detailed way in his first work. And it's something that also, you know, it's part of the collective memory of the villagers, this sense of being deprived of the very source of what forms their sustenance, because the source of in the village was mostly devoted to the gardens, to the vegetable gardens. And so taking that water meant basically destroying their livelihood. And that was very austere. And that was actually a moment where the villagers mobilized alongside Palestinian nationalists in order to ask for justice with the British administrators. And so it's really interesting to see how this, there was a new forum for this conflict, which now was the Mandate government, which of course had different ways of approaching it.
I guess the Ottomans and the British, I mean, there's a lot of similarities between the two, but I don't know much about how the British handled this question, but I'm sure they had their own ways. Out of curiosity, really out of ignorance for the most part, who were the people in Artas? I mean, in terms of their particular religious identity, are we talking about a village that is mostly Muslim, Christians, mixed?
Actually, Artas is a Muslim village, but it is located next to a Catholic convent, the Hortus Conclusus, which many of you might know, because it's also sort of a picture postcard, perfect image of this white convent in the middle of the Green Valley. And it was actually built in the very early 20th century at the initiative of Uruguay. So it was mostly a Latin American sisters convent.
I remember reading about it when I was working on the diary of a Spanish consul during the First World War. He loved going to Artas to the convent, and mostly because, again, they were Spanish speakers. And he mentioned occasionally, obviously, Artas, the villagers, and the question of water, but I was never really able to gather the details about who were the people, the villagers, you know, in general. So it's interesting, like, just to sort of map not just the city, but also the surrounding, which is part of a city in itself. I want to move to you know, further up sort of the chronological ladder, and you co-wrote an article with Yasmin Avcher and Vincent Lemire. I think it was co-written, but you might prove me wrong. The Chronique du Mort Annoncé, la municipalité ottomane de Jérusalem dans la tourmente de la Première Guerre mondiale. So, yeah, my French is not great, but essentially the chronicle of a death foretold and the Jerusalem Ottoman municipality during the First World War. And I was wondering if you can give us a sense of basically this passage, because what we have through your work is this late Ottoman, the war itself, which proved to be, you know, from obviously perspective, you know, a later perspective, proved to be the end of the municipality. And then, of course, later on, the British. So how did the municipality of Jerusalem work, if it worked, during the war?
Yeah, that article, actually, I'm solely responsible for. But I did write another article about the Ottoman municipality with Vincent and Yasmin. So yeah, that article tries to look actually at the very last daftar, the very last register of municipal council minutes that we have available for 1917. And it's a sad document to read in many ways. Especially when you know what stood at the end of it, but even so, it's very different in its contents from what we read before. There's new protagonists, and we feel that there's a new role for the municipality that didn't assume in that way before. And if we read it at the same time as these crucial resources that are constituted by Wesef Johariya's journals and Turjuman's journals, then actually we get a real sense of the shift in the role of the municipal council. The municipal council actually during that period sort of had to at the same time assume its role of in some ways a caretaker of the population. But as Wesef Johariya tells us, it also played its role, the gendarma of the municipality also played their role in confiscating goods for the army. And that was something that was, of course, a very austere measure for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And so the relationship, which traditionally hadn't been antagonistic, started to change during that period. But it's interesting, we feel that it's really a city in crisis, at the same time, here and there, we see that there's still plans for the future. There's one decision relating to a new project for a municipal park, for example. It's interesting to read that in the midst war, the sort of issues that come up during war, like epidemic outbreaks, etc. So it's a very interesting register to have a look at. We also noticed that the store owners changed. I mean, the municipality generated a lot of income through renting out stores that it owned, especially around Jaffa Gate, Bab el Khalil. And all of a sudden, we find women renting stores. So this also goes to tell us, you know, how the demographic changes affected the city.
It's fascinating that in this period of time, as you mentioned, there is a war going on. There's tragedy throughout the city, you know, poverty, starvation, sickness. Through the diaries of Wesef Johariya, you know, Isan Turjman, you get also the sense of a, you know, position of women, in particularly many that had to turn to prostitution in order to survive and have their children survive in the war. And yet you have urban planning. I mean, Jamal Pasha, as governor of Ottoman Syria and Palestine, was still planning the gardens, boulevards, buildings. But not only at the level of the governorship, but also, as you mentioned, at the municipal level. So it's fascinating to see how, in any case, the life of the city was moving forward. But then, as you mentioned, 1917, the British arrived, and in a sense, everything changed in terms of the approach, not in terms of the institution. The institutions are still there. And so I was wondering if now we can, you know, start moving to talk about the municipality under the British. How did it work? What are the changes? And then later on, obviously, I'm going to ask about this question of demunicipalization, which I think is a very important and intriguing aspect of your work.
Yes, the municipality continued in its form during the British Mandate, of course. But what I argue is that it was eroded in its substance. Because you have worked on this, and actually this whole idea of demunicipalization in some ways is an echo to what you have been working on concerning Ronald Storrs and the Pro-Jerusalem Society. Because when you realize that in Jerusalem under Ronald Storrs, there was this creation of alternative sort of competing institutions, which were supposed to assume some of the roles that the municipality had, then we can realize in which ways actually the substance of municipal power was eroded. As you know better than me, actually Charles Ashby was the one signing building permits in the 1920s. And this is really, let's say, the very basis of the power of a municipality to decide, you know, the use of the space of the city. And it's interesting because he seems to be rather aware also of assuming some municipal functions as the secretary of this Pro-Jerusalem Society. So the municipality changed significantly during that period. And we actually have to read it at the same time as reading the history of those alternative competing institutions such as the Pro-Jerusalem Society that you work on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
I was wondering also the extent which which the municipality changed, not only because of the arrival of the British, but also obviously because of the arrival in mass of Zionists. And they not only brought people, but they also brought capital and experts in their own ways, in their own fields. And that obviously played a role in how the city was then reimagined also through those channels. So, I mean, sometimes it feels that it's just the British that are controlling the municipality, but yet there are different communities. And, you know, obviously there are the Palestinians, but now we also have the new actors in the shape and the form of a Zionist.
Yes, precisely. And it's interesting, when you look at the composition of the pro-Jerusalem society, you see that there's a different logic at work. It's a representational logic, and it's a confessional logic, because, you know, it's now the idea is to have the different patriarchs and the different representatives of different religious groups, some consuls. You can complete the list. I don't remember, but it's interesting. It's really it's a completely different logic compared to the logic of a municipal council that's elected. Whatever the basis might be, and we know that it was censitary suffrage at the time, but the principle of political participation has changed from election to representation, and I think that's fundamental. And that's something that was taken from the people of Jerusalem, who had had this experience of municipal elections for several decades before the British arrived. And you know, as we know from the work of Michel Compass, also people really made use of the liberties that they had in such moments as the 1908 revolution, and even if many of that didn't lead to, you know, whatever ambition was there, it forged a certain level of expectation, and I think that expectation was completely disappointed. And, you know, we can read it in Wasef Jawahiri's diary. He was happy, first of all, to be liberated from the Ottomans. And then slowly he sobered up, and he actually became very disappointed with the sort of system that he saw evolving around him under the British mandate.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Yeah, particularly because he was working for Ronald Stories. He was working in that department. So he could see firsthand how the city was being rebuilt or being built and also planned. So I guess at some point he's... anti-Ottoman fervor changed, and he became a little bit more conscious of the fact that actually, you know, the British were not really bringing what he might have expected, probably. And again, there's also the question of the Zionists, who obviously changes not only the demographic of the city, but also the power balance between the various actors. And you mentioned the Pro-Jerusalem Society, which was essentially a private institution. And certainly at the beginning of the British War, it was rather powerful. But then with the institution of a town planning commission, we have a proper classic British institution taking over, where there's a sort of a different hierarchical structure, and also more elected officials are part of that. So I was wondering, you know, first of all, what was the Town Planning Commission and how it relates to the municipality and how they worked together and planned Jerusalem during the mandate?
Yeah, I had a chance to work a little bit more on that since I first published on this issue of demunicipalization. So as you said, the Town Planning Commission actually took over from the Pro-Jerusalem Society in 1920. And it was then responsible for defining the city's boundaries, zoning, and for arranging 8 new neighborhoods in the new city. It also retained the right to review all building permit applications, as I said earlier, thus really taking what sort of constitutes the physical basis of the power of the municipality. And it was also the only body that was authorized to receive complaints about urban planning. So in many ways, the Town Planning Commission had a much more decisive role compared to the municipality. The municipality in some ways had to execute what the Town Planning Commission decided. And that was a clear change from prior dynamics, notably under Ottoman rule.
You mentioned earlier that this idea of demunicipalization is about erosion of power. And I was wondering if this, what you just mentioned, the fact that in the end, it was the Town Planning Commission dictating what the municipality could do, is the very heart of this idea of demunicipalizations. Because one thing that struck me is that we've been talking about this for quite some time, and we never mention mayors. It looks like they're not really relevant. Well, when you look at and you think about municipalities nowadays, but even obviously in decades earlier, you often have, mayors who do represent the municipality, and in a sense, they represent the city. But here it seems like they're not really relevant.
Yeah, I think the vision that the British had of the mayors was more representative, again, rather than political. And it's a message that they expressed also by dismissing, for example, Musa Qasim al-Husseini in the early 1920s. Because when his role became political, I think it was Ronald Storrs who told him, well, basically you decide either it's politics or it's city administration. And a similar message was addressed to Hussein Fakhri al-Khalidi, who was mayor during the Great Arab Revolt. And when he took sides with this revolt, he was dismissed and he was sent to the Seychelles into exile. So it was clear that for the British, the municipality was not a locus for politics. It was a locus for urban governments in the very technocratic sense of the word, and for what they called maybe the good management of sectarian strife. Because there's an interesting dynamic. I mean, at the very moment where there's a sense that the very basis of representation is changing and of political participation is changing and is becoming more and more confessional, the British also seem very concerned with sectarian strife. So it's almost as though they were afraid of what they were creating with their own policies. They created electoral wards along confessional lines. If we look at also the issue of municipal council elections, it's very interesting to look at the rules for suffrage that were being discussed in the 1930s, because they have a difficult time deciding how to actually limit the right to suffrage, since it was so difficult in any case to sort of create some system of elected representation on the level of the whole country. I mean, that was basically over from 1923 on. That was clear. There would not be a legislative council. Their hopes turned towards the municipalities, and they thought that maybe those could be sorts of testing grounds for local democracy or and for self-governance, because in some ways they were also supposed to encourage that as part of the mandate. But yeah, they could not decide how to work on municipal suffrage, thus decided for a while to actually stay with the Ottoman suffrage system. And when it came down to drafting a first bill for about municipal elections, we can see this hesitation in the archives, actually. How do we call the people who are going to have the right to vote? Are they Palestinian citizens? Are they inhabitants of the country? Are they townsmen? What age do they have to be? How many pounds of taxes do they have to pay? I mean, all of this you can see, you know, in the archives. It takes a long time for them to decide. And finally, when they decide, in many ways, they just decide to put off the final decision a little bit longer and to leave many things up to local administrations to decide. So what we have in the late 1930s is various systems of municipal suffrage implemented in different cities. I mean, the most radical difference, for example, is that in Tel Aviv, women were allowed to vote. And that was the only place in all of Palestine where women were allowed to vote. So it's very interesting to look at those schedules.
Mm. It sounds as if the British were inconsistent in their policy. I mean, from day one, since they took over Palestine from the Ottomans. I mean, I know it sounds like a cliche that obviously the British were inconsistent in the wartime agreements, Balfour Declaration and the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And, you know, that's one level, but from what you said and also from the work of many others, you really get the sense that the British never really understood how the dynamics worked in Palestine, and they reacted only locally, creating this microcosm where you have all of these different rules and regulations for which, you know, in Haifa you can do something, but not necessarily in Jerusalem. And on the other hand, and this is more like, I guess, a legacy of it, certainly of you know, the very beginning of British rule, I found always interesting that the work of Ronald Storrs, Charles Ashby, and particularly of Ronald Storrs, who, honestly, there's not much written about him, when he made certain decisions like to adopt the white stone, the so-called white stone of Jerusalem, eventually that affected the entire region. So throughout the mandate and in the decades even afterwards, and even when the West Bank was under Jordanian control and, you know, the Israel on the other side, but still people kept building, relying on these kind of rules. So you travel around the country now and houses are white. And again, there's nothing biblical or, you know, millennia old, but actually it was the decisions of Roland Storr that eventually was applied throughout the country. So I found interesting this kind of dual division where you have inconsistencies, and on the other hand, you have like certain small decisions, but that eventually impacted everybody in the region. So I was wondering what you think about it. I mean, how do you see that the work of the British in general?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, there is a certain level of inconsistency, which we can attribute in part to the fact that not all of them had the same view on the finality of the mandate. There were some clearly pro-Zionist mandate administrators, and there were others who had a very different kind of view. I also find it interesting to look at the sort of colonial replication of models. And Nicholas Roberts has done this really nicely in analyzing the Supreme Muslim Council, which was this bizarre creation in some ways of the British administrators who wanted to find a way out of this difficulty of not having an Arab agency as the equivalent of the Jewish agency. And so they created the Supreme Muslim Council decided that this was going to now be the main representative body for Palestinian Arabs. And so I think it's fruitful, and I'm looking forward to reading more about these sort of comparisons, actually, about British colonialism, for example, in India and in Africa, and the way these models sometimes then were exported. And it makes some sort of erratic decisions maybe a little bit more understandable, because they do hark back to an experience, even if that experience wasn't Palestinian, even if it was Indian or Kenyan or, yeah.
And in a sense, this makes Jerusalem part of the British Empire, something that many scholars, but I think also people never really thought and realized that for decades, Jerusalem was part of another empire, not the Ottomans, but the British. And in that sense, it was interconnected with all the other places around the world that the British controlled, from Northern Ireland to India, Canada, South Africa, obviously, you know, various African countries and territories, and it all connected. And probably there, the locus of this inconsistency, you know, sending people with no expertise of the region, but they did understand empire. And so maybe even for us, it's hard to understand.
No, I was just saying that I think the sort of empire-centered perspective can be really interesting for us sometimes, especially when we're very much working on local history, on micro history. It's really rather breathtaking to see how we can compare this on the level of the empire. Mm.
And I realized that only recently, when I was reading more about other cities in the region, particularly Haifa, and I really realized that Haifa came to be this economic center mostly because of the connection with the empire. So the oil pipes connecting from Iraq, newly created Iraq, into Haifa and then expanding from there. And the British had this vision of Haifa really at the center of the Mediterranean. And so I connected the dots and I said, well, Jerusalem too is part of the empire. And so maybe I can understand better British rule if I think about how the British envision empire. And, you know, it's a long process. I want to ask you something connected to this before we talk about your upcoming book. Do you see any legacy of the Ottoman and the British municipality in the post-1948 era, which also meant, two different municipalities up to 1967? And then once again brought together after the Six-Day War, again, of 1967. Do you see any legacy, anything that has remained and is still somehow part of a functioning system of a current municipality?
That's a very interesting question. And I think it would be interesting also to have the point of view of Hanin Naanmeh, who's worked on actually the Jordanian municipality of Jerusalem. I think it's fascinating as we sort of work from one period to the other, and as we look at the different moments of change and transformation. There's always some things that remain for the post 1948 municipality. It's interesting to consider the new place that Jerusalem actually had, because now it was part of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. So it was a real shift in terms of the centrality that Jerusalem had under the British mandate. And now being the second city after Amman in some ways. So that was in some ways a change of status, even if, you know, city was exalted, of course, as a spiritual center also for the Hashemite Kingdom, etc. there was a shift, and with the 1967 occupation, the municipal council of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, did not end. It moved to Amman. And so that's also interesting to look at a municipal council in exile. What does that mean to continue working as a municipal council while you have been displaced and dispossessed? So that's also fascinating, and it's work to be done, for sure.
One thing that struck me in the recent crisis in Sheikh Jarrah, which is not recent, it's been going on now for a decade, it's the fact that there's been a growing interest in the Ottoman municipality, and people began to look for TAPU registry, basically cadastre registry, in order to prove who owned what and whether it was owned or rented. And so in a sense, it's like, well, the municipality was there for a reason and they did their job. They recorded that. Now, most of the records are in Istanbul. They're not necessarily accessible. But I guess for me, it showed the centrality of the municipality as a record keeper. And, you know, now obviously the current situation is dramatic and very problematic. But again, the municipality is central because they keep these records and can help people, you know, sorting out issues. Obviously, Sheikh Jarrah is another story in that sense, but it really brought back the sense of the importance and centrality of the municipality.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you think about it.
It reminds of the centrality of the municipality and of the centrality of municipal control over the space of the city. And I think this is also one of the issues of this dynamic of demunicipalization that occurred during the British mandate, because actually the municipal council, while it continued to exist, did not have any mastery over the space of the city anymore. And that's actually fundamental. You, in some ways, you, if you uproot a municipality, then it can't fulfill the primary function it has.
Well, I guess it feels like maybe we can say that if you uproot the municipality, in a sense, you take away not necessarily the soul of the city, but certainly a major aspect of the city itself, something that keeps the city together, at least in administrative terms, but also I would say even more than administrative terms, because eventually the municipality is about services, about trying to mediate between people, and also thinking about the future, because that's what the municipality is for, is to gather plans and think about expansion and new businesses and new ideas about the city itself.
Yes, precisely. Yeah. And that's also what was dramatic actually during the British period, because this role of town planning was not among the prerogatives of the municipality anymore. That was the Town Planning Commission now, which was very much working under the influence of the High Commissioner. So it was very much of a British-dominated instance with a lot of input from Zionist leaders, but with virtually no connection to the municipalities.
I have one last question. And I really want to talk about your upcoming work. Now, the book is going to be published in 2022. It's going to be in French, hopefully one day translated into English. La Palestine entre patrimonie et providence, régime d'historicité et mémoire au village d'Acta. Now, obviously, the work is connected to what we talked about earlier about the village of Artas. But can you give us a sort of a flavor of the book, and what will readers find in the book?
Yeah, actually, it's a book that takes Artas as an observatory for the first instances of European and American presence in Ottoman Palestine, and also of the echo of that presence in collective memory. As many of you know, the Valley of Artas attracted pilgrims, explorers, and biblical researchers as early as the 16th century. Because of this supposed link with the heritage of King Solomon. But then in the mid-19th century, the village actually became the favorite site of settlement for millenarist Christians. And this presence facilitated later on the arrival of researchers whose work then resonated strongly among villagers in the context of Israeli occupation. So it's a mixture of a historical approach and an oral history approach. And one thing I tried to do is to move away from this binary reading of the relationship between East and West and to really focus on what the power relations were during the end of the Ottoman period and during the British Mandate, based on the comparison of local archives, British archives, German archives, etc. The intersection of this historical analysis then with the oral history accounts reveals how this period is either recalled, interpreted, or forgotten by the inhabitants of the village and also by the descendants of Europeans who lived in the village. And ultimately, these narratives shed light on the meanings attributed to history. And that's something that I'm very interested in. So, the idea is to also attribute a certain importance to these meanings that oral history will give to history. In some ways it's a meeting ground between the meta history of humanity, if you think about millenarist expectations, and Palestinian microstoria, really in a very, very local history sense. And at the same time, it tries to open up a new perspective on a period that was really pivotal for Palestine.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about the municipality or Artas that you would like to talk about?
No, but maybe I'll take advantage of this opportunity to thank you for the inspiration that your work has provided to mine and for the inspiration that the work of so many dear colleagues has provided, because I really think that for the last 10 years, we've sort of built a community of scholars who regularly converse about various issues concerning Jerusalem, and this has been very stimulating.
This was Falestine Naili, a historian associated with the Institut Français du Prochain Orient in Amman. She has an upcoming book that we already heard about it in 2022, La Palestine entre patrimonie et providence, about Artas. Falestine, thank you so much.
Thank you, Roberto.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.